This is Trainer Talk on HRRN Live. HRRN
Live. But it was all for Chuck McGee. Super Saver wins the Derby for Todd Pletcher.
The Salt will give trainer Steve Asmussen career win number 6,000.
It was all have another for Doug O'Neill.
Oxbow and D-Wayne Lucas. Trainer D-Wayne Lucas, a sixth win.
And Al's Rosie is going to give trainer Gary Contessa his 2,000th career win.
And dialed in, never got to them. It was Animal Kingdom for Graham Motion.
Steve Hobby with career victory number 1,000 at Oakland.
Presented by Basic Tipton. Now, here's Mike Pena.
Good afternoon once again, everyone, and welcome to Trainer Talk presented by Phasic Tipton here on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Mike Pena, Baron of the Backstretch, with you for the next hour, as always, on this Wednesday evening in studio with my producer, Lee Delapina. And each and every week on this program, we have the opportunity to visit with so many trainers that make this sport go. And we get to hear their stories and their backgrounds and how they got started in the game. Each one unique, but in so many ways, a lot of them very similar as well. And looking forward to tonight's show. Going to be joined by trainer Mike Marina in the first half of the program. And then Terry Pompey will join us in the second half of the show tonight. So without further ado, let's get right to it. The well-traveled native of Southern California who grew up in the shadows of Hollywood Park. He has saddled 191 career winners. His name is Mike Marina, and nice enough to be with us here on Trainer Talk presented by Phasic Tipton tonight. Mike, thanks for taking the time.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, happy to have you on board. And, you know, it's an interesting thing. I talk about you growing up next to Hollywood Park. Your career has really had so many twists and turns, as many as any trainer out there. Where did it all begin for Mike Marina? How did you get hooked on horses?
Actually, as a youngster, like you said, I was born very close to Hollywood Park and then actually moved over by Playa del Rey when we were younger and lived over in that area. And when I was in ninth grade, I had a chance to go to Hawaii either surfing with a very good friend of mine. His grandmother lived there, and I surfed and lived, you know, by the ocean then. Or my mom said you could go get a horse, because I was always going to a friend's place and riding horses there every weekend out in Palos Verdes and stuff, because I enjoyed riding. So I said, well, I'll buy a horse, you know, and stuff. So anyway, and I kept it at a boarding stable and, you know, started riding and things a lot there. In fact, every day and stuff. You know, it turned into kind of like a passion for me, you know. And then like a year and a half, 2 years later, I went in my first horse show and I won, you know, the very first class I went in, and I won like three classes and a second that day. And then I was hooked on it and kind of stayed hooked on it and stuff, and ended up training, you know, being a show horse trainer and stuff for a number of years in the early 70s to the mid 70s, you know, like up to about 76 or 7. And trained quarter horses, paint horses, world champions and stuff. I had one of the best quarter horses, halter horses in the country, named Impressive Dandy, and had numerous students, you know, like up to 40 students and stuff, and won all kinds of high points in California and across the country, and then national shows, qualified a lot of horses for the World Quarter Horse Shows, Western Pleasure, you know, Quarter Horse Congress, all that kind of stuff. And then got to a certain age there, about when I was 26 or 7, and I said, I wonder what I'm really going to do for a living. You know? And I broke some racehorses for a guy at Los Alamitos, and I had always broke horses, got on them, broke them and stuff and everything. And he had sent me some horses and told me he would pay me double, which I thought, wow, if I could get him going in 30 days and he could get him through a starting gate, and, you know, take them to Los Alamitos. And he sent me six horses in, and it was like big money for me. So I broke them and stuff, and I rode them in and out of a trailer to get used to a gate since I didn't have a starting gate and stuff. And ended up, they all did well, you know, and stuff down there. And I said, man, there's big money in this race and stuff. But I decided that I'd, you know, try to go into the racing end of it a little bit. And I really didn't care about racing quarter horses, even though I'd had a couple and stuff, because it seemed like all my friends that did the quarter horse racing, I mean, they did real good, but it's never seemed to me like they made much money doing it. They would do, they'd be like leading, second leading, third leading trainers at the meets and stuff and everything. And this is when Lucas was like big time in the quarter horses then too, or whatever and stuff. And, you know, then they leave town, own the feed man, own this guy, own that guy and everything else and stuff. And there didn't seem as many places to run your horses. You know, when I studied it and I looked at thoroughbreds back then in California, you had Caliente going, you had, you know, Del Mar, Hollywood, Santa Anita, Bay Meadows, Golden Gate, you had the fairs, you had, you know, Turf Paradise, you had a lot of places to run thoroughbreds, and there was a lot of places, you know, for the thoroughbreds, and they had all the farms out there close to where I was, you know, out in Chino, Riverside, you know, San Bernardino area and all that. So it just seemed to me the thoroughbreds was kind of the thing to get into.
You know, a lot of people will think that
I went to work for a trainer. My uncle was head account and track controller at Hollywood Park. And when they had the strikes for the machines or whatever, I happened to work for him, you know, go in and work the machines. And this girl next to me, her brother-in-law was Lauren Rotelli. And she told me that. And she said she had a little farm there. And would I come out and help her clip the horses and this or that at the farm and everything and stuff? And I said, sure. So I went out one day or something and to the farm there, and he happened to show up, and, you know, we did some work with some horses out there and stuff. And he asked me if I was interested in working on the racetrack at all. And I said, well, I don't know. I hadn't really thought about it much, you know, and stuff. And I said, he said, why don't you come by one morning? So I come by, and he was complaining about a wrap on a horse or something, a polo on a horse or something. And he said, can you put a polo on that horse, change it? And I put it on, and he looked at it and stuff. He said, are you sure you don't want to go to work? And I said, okay. And I said, you know, I mean, I'd quit the show horses. I'd been in Arizona and Scottsdale, and I'd had about 50 in training there. And I just decided I was kind of tired of it, you know, or something. So I went into Hollywood Park, you know, like, and then back then you went in at 4, 4:30 in the morning. And I walked hots for about 3 days, and I went from hot walker to a groom. And then from a groom to run in the shed row in a matter of a week's time. So
wow.
It was a rapid progression, I guess, because I don't know. I didn't speak any Mexican either, but, you know, and stuff. And I could, you know, get them to understand everything and do stuff and everything like that. We had about 45 horses there. So anyway, I started going in at 3:30 in the morning so I could walk six. There was no walking machines or anything before we start and everything and stuff like that, and kind of moved my way up the ladder there. And then I went with Golden Act, which was a good horse he had. That horse ended up winning like Louisiana Derby, Arkansas Derby, El Camino Real, and then he ran like third in the Kentucky Derby to Spectacular Bid, and then second in the Preakness and second in the Belmont to Coastal or whatever. And then won a bunch of grass races that year and stuff and everything, and went with him the second year back there when he switched to the grass and traveled with the horse to Arlington and won the Canadian International he did, and then stayed in New York like 2 months and everything and stuff, and ran in the big races there when they had the fall classics for the grass horses back then for Horse of the Year and everything. You know, it was, they had all those races back on the East Coast then and stuff.
Sure.
And then I would stay at Hollywood Park with about 40 young horses. And he stayed at Santa Anita since he lived by Santa Anita and stuff. And so I just stayed there and had like 40 horses for him. And, the comebackers, the horse had been laid off or injured or something, and the babies, and just get them all ready there and stuff like that. And at that time, everybody wanted to stay at Santa Anita, so Hollywood was easier to be at. Plus, I lived by the beach there, so it was very convenient for me anyway, you know. So.
Well, you know, Mike, anyway, a lot of people would say you were crazy for giving up a surfing career in Hawaii to be at the racetrack and to train racehorses. But it sounds to me like you really learned the game from the ground level up. Is that right?
Yeah, that's the truth. I mean, you know, the truth was, I sometimes have a hard time with trainers that have never rode. I mean, I look at it and do they really know what a horse feels like underneath them? You know, I mean, it's fine to listen to gallop people and listen to your riders and stuff like that, but I would find it very hard to to believe a trainer that's never really rode a lot and broke horses and been on them and felt them move and stuff like that, really have the feel for what it is that a horse feels like when you're looking at it move. You know what I mean? So to me, I've always felt, you know, with all the riding stuff and everything I did and working, like you said, from the ground up and everything. And I worked for Lauren for nearly 5 years, 4.5, 5 years. I had numerous other job offers, and I didn't want to take them because I was kind of a loyal person, and I felt he was one of the top trainers at the time. And we were, like, in the top 10 trainers in the country, like, 3 out of the 4 years or something that I worked for him and stuff. And back then, it was over the million mark in earnings, if you can believe that. That was a big deal back then. So,
wow.
Anyway, you know, I was comfortable with that. And I felt people that just jumped around from place to place to place never really learned, like, you know, like something. And Lauren had worked for Van Berg and run his whole string. And Lauren had been in charge, you know, and the head of it when Frankie Brothers and Mott and Catalano, all those people worked for Bamberg. Lauren had been in charge of it then, and Lauren Gallup too and stuff, you know. So, you know, I felt it was a good source of knowledge and a good way to learn. The only thing I didn't know is Lauren never talked. So anything you learned, you just had to learn by watching and observing and then seeing where he spotted his horses and when he changed riders. And, you know, he wasn't a big one to talk a lot about it, you know, and stuff. So you really had to observe a lot and pick up on it that way, you know, and stuff. So that's how that got started, you know.
Well,
and then I kind of quit Lauren.
Yeah,
went on my own.
Speaking,
and,
yeah, learning.
Literally got my butt kicked down at Hollywood and Santa Anita with the junk horses I had. So I decided it probably would be a better spot to be up north, you know, in Northern California and stuff with the kind of horses I had, you know, and stuff. So I went up to Northern California then and stayed up there for, you know, about 7, 8 years or whatever, 9 years, and trained up there. But the only trouble with Northern California at the time and probably then was that you really don't get people that raise good horses in Northern California. Mainly what you get is I had numerous trainers send horses up to me and stuff. And, they were horses that were really slow or couldn't cut it at all down there or broke down horses, you know, and that's basically what you got sent to you up there, you know. So, you know, there was not really a lot of shot of having ever get good horses up there. And the people that actually lived up there, it's funny, they don't really like to spend a lot of money for good horses. So you really don't have much shot of ever getting back to having good horses. And I'd been used to having them. And I enjoyed them a lot and stuff, you know, and everything. And then, you know, what you're doing is basically you're just trying to break cheap horse maidens for 62.5 or 7,500 and this and that and stuff. And you know, you don't really get top-notch horses that way. So I got kind of bored with it. And then I decided that what I'd do is just move up to Washington and raise horses and put them in the sales and stuff and everything up there in Washington and kind of get away with from the track a little bit, you know, not as much, and be out in the country more and you know, that type of thing and everything. And the first year I do it, they closed Longacres. So I was up there and then they closed Longacres. And I'd bred about 6, 7 mares and I had babies in the sales and thought we could, you know, make a living doing that and everything, and then realized that wasn't going to work, you know, because the sale went downhill there and Longacres was closing. There wasn't going to be a track for a while. Boeing had bought it and stuff and everything. So there I was stuck up there with, you know, no way to make a living again or something. So anyway, just kicked around for a bit. And then Bobby Frankel needed an assistant. Mary Knight had told me to go see Bobby. And he was looking for an assistant to take the Judmont horses, some horses back east and stuff. So I went there and seen Bobby. And I'd worked for Terry Knight some and helped Terry Knight and stuff. And he'd been real good to me and stuff and helped Terry and stuff. He'd sent me horses when I'd been up north before when he was in Southern Cal and stuff. And anyway, then I went to work for Bobby and then I went to the fairgrounds and then to Kentucky with the string. And then Bobby said, well, we're going to stay in Kentucky. And I said, really? I said, that's great. And I looked at the prices of living and homes and everything living in Kentucky. And I said, boy, this is great. You know, I can afford to live here. Well, just as soon as I got comfortable with the idea and thought about moving and called my wife and told her we're going to move to Kentucky, and this is great, you know. Bobby says, well, we're moving to New York. I decided we're going to keep the string in New York, you know. And I said, New York? I said, I don't know. I'm not going to New York. I had a 5-6-year-old, and I said, you know what? I'm not raising a kid in New York. I'll be honest with you, Bobby. I like Kentucky a lot better for that. So, Bobby, he didn't think I wasn't, but I ended up not going to New York and stuff. But I did good with Bobby. We went in the Oaks that year and won about 7-8 races at that meet at Churchill. And Bobby had been 0-32, as Indian Charlie had pointed out, in Kentucky up to that point. So anyway, it'd been good. And it was great working for Bobby, too. He was great to work for, you know, as you know, people sometimes had a misconception about how Bobby was to work for. Bobby was, you know, really strict about stuff, but he was actually very, very good and let you do, when you had the horses, he let you do basically what you wanted to do. And what he did is if you were going to fail, he let you fail. And if you were going to do well, he let you do well. You know what I mean? So it's kind of funny. You know, we had our moments, but we did really well. So,
well, you learn from the best with a guy like Frankel.
I moved to Kentucky because I said, you know, it's obvious they don't raise horses in California anymore. There are no horses here. And you know where they raise horses? They raise them in Kentucky. So if you're going to train and you want to train, Kentucky's probably the place to be. So we moved to Kentucky. So anyway, that's how that deal got started.
And wasn't there a stint with Phil Hoswell at some point as well?
Yeah, that deal in between Bobby for a stint for Hoswell for a year there while Phil was getting ready to move to New York or something.
Yep.
So that I filled in that year when I moved to Kentucky and didn't have a job because I actually had moved there then, you know. So I didn't have a job. So Phil was getting ready to move to New York, and he was going to go to New York for the summer, you know, and Saratoga, and then he had the horse Middlesex Drive for the Breeders' Cup or whatever and stuff, and he needed somebody to run the barn in New York and everything. I mean, in Kentucky and stuff. So then I did that for Phil. And Phil had a banner year that year. Phil did great that year. And then Phil wanted to know if I'd go to New York. You know, I said, look, if I didn't go for Bobby Frankel, Phil, please. You know, I didn't go there. Needless to say, I said, Jesus, everybody wants to go to New York, you know. So I said, I started training in Kentucky, and I picked up an owner, Gus Goldsmith, and he had quite a few horses and stuff, and started with him actually and stuff, and did real well for him and everything, and kind of just rolled on from then. And then I picked up Dr. Alday there, lived down the road from me, and was pretty good friends with me and stuff. And then he picked me up, this owner, Ernest Keeney, for Keeney Racing, and I picked them up and started having a lot of horses for them and everything. And we had so many babies, Kentucky wasn't ideal for the winters anymore, you know, when you got 20, 25, you know, yearlings to break and get going and stuff. So like everybody else, we thought about, you know, moving to Florida then to Ocala, you know, and stuff. So that's how that happened. And we switched and moved to Ocala and, you know, kept a barn here at a training center in Ocala so we could get all the babies going and stuff like that during the winters and everything. And my son was golfing a lot. And so it was important to be at a place where you could practice all the time and golf, you know, constantly. So. And that's how that started. And then they still suckered me into New York for the last couple of years.
You know? Talking with trainer Mike Marina here on Trainer Talk presented by Faisal Tipton on the Horse Racing Radio Network. You know, Mike, one other thing that you, I'm sure, take a lot of pride in is that you've been part of the early careers of so many top horses, including a little horse by the name of Game On Dude. And I know that had to be somewhat special for you to see the way he's progressed throughout his career and know that you were the one responsible for getting him started.
Yeah, I bought him.
Yeah.
I actually bought him as a yearling. Yeah. And that's a great story in itself. And that the owner, he actually RNA'd when we were there bidding on him, and the owner kind of fell asleep with his hands in his pocket. And then they hit the hammer, and I said, that's the horse you knew we wanted, this horse. I was sitting there. I kept telling you, go on it. I love this horse. And we had had a horse that year named One Awesome Dude. and awesome again that I'd done real well with. I'd won some little stakes with him and won some allowance races with him. He ended up winning the Claiming Crown big race too, you know, and after I bought Game On Dude, actually. So, and Game On Dude was the total opposite of most awesome agains in that he had a lot of leg to him. You know, he was a stretchier horse and wasn't so compact and, you know, wasn't quirky looking. So anyway, I loved him. I loved the stride on him when he walked. I loved the ranginess of him, the scopiness and stuff. So anyway, I went back to the hotel and I seen he'd RNA'd. So I called the owner. I said, come on, we got to get down there right away and see if we can make a deal and get this horse. So anyway, we managed to get it done. And then we were leaving the next day on Monday. We bought him on a Sunday, and on Monday we were leaving. And that's when the stock market, you know, bottomed out on that Monday.
Yep.
And all I heard for the next 10 hours driving back up to Delaware with the owner was, Jesus Christ, I had never bought that horse. I'd known the market was going to do this and everything else and stuff. But it all turned out to be a pretty good deal, you know. So.
Well, and I can imagine that when you see what he's accomplished throughout his career, you must take a huge amount of pride in that, knowing, hey, I was right all along.
Yeah, you do. You know, I knew I always liked him, and I knew he'd get a route of ground. And you know, he turned out to be a really, really good horse, you know, for Baffert and stuff. And you do. You're happy with it. You know, a lot of people always say, are you upset you didn't have him? Are you upset, you know, this or that and everything and stuff? And I'm not really upset at all about it. I was glad to see him progress and do well. And everything else, you know, and stuff. And he turned out to be, you know, one in a, what would you say, one in 100,000, 250,000 million type horse, you know what I mean? He turned out to be a really, really good horse. He stayed sound, you know, and he's proven himself really well, you know, and everything. And, you know, people always ask, well, why'd you cut him? Well, when I had him before and I was working him when he was a colt, this horse wouldn't work past 52, you know, when he was a colt. I mean, constantly wouldn't switch leads behind. He wouldn't do this. He wouldn't do that. And I told the owner, I said, I know you're not going to like to hear this, but I said, you know what? I think we need to cut this horse. And I know we paid almost $250,000 for him, but I said, I think if we cut him, he's going to be all right. Cause nobody in the barn liked him. He was kind of roguey acting and stuff. And just, you know, wasn't with it at all. And we cut him, and within 6 weeks' time, he started working bullets down at Gulfstream, you know, and stuff. Just absolutely, you know, boom, just turned the corner like that. And then the first time I ran him, I was very shocked how much speed he showed in the race early, because before you couldn't melt and pour him on the front end, you know, or anything. You know, he would just lope along and do nothing. And then, in that first race, they smoked down there. I believe they went 7/8 and 21 and change or something. And he was fairly close on it, you know, and stuff, and barely got beat first time I run him at 7/8. And then I came back at a mile, and he broke terrible. The guy had hold of him in the gate, and he reared up and stuff and everything. He's always been an odd gate horse. You can take him to the gate, you know, like Baffert took him to the gate a bunch of times and schooled him and stuff, and you still never know whether he's going to come out perfect or he's going to do his stuff at the gate. You know, he's just always been one of his little things that he does, his quirks, you know. But he spotted the field about 10 that day, and then he went by about 10 lengths, drawing away Jeremy Rose on him, just loped home, put the whip away. And then Baffert's people bought into him a day before the Florida Derby or whatever and stuff and everything. And he wasn't... He had had a little bit of a cough and stuff going into the Florida Derby and stuff. And every horse that day on the front end had stopped. And that was the Florida Derby where I think it was Icebox and the horse of Ramsey's, I think of Kitten's Joy. They both came from last and second to last and won 1-2, you know. So yep. All the horses been on the front end backed up that day. The track was slow. So anyway, and then it was on to Baffert from there, you know. So that was that story, and Baffert's done really, really well with him, you know. You can't deny that horse ain't been a really, really good horse, you know.
Well, Mike, only about 3 or 4 minutes left here before we have to wrap things up. Believe it or not, it's kind of flown by here this afternoon, but do want to ask you about a couple of other horses that maybe stand out to you outside of Game On Dude. You've been around so many good horses in your career. Which other horses would you say, okay, I'm never gonna forget these horses?
Oh man, that's hard to say there. You know, it's you know, there's horses you've had in your career and they might not have been, Candyman E is a horse that I've always liked a lot. Okay. And that was a horse that I had bought in a pasture for less than $10,000 in Kentucky and turned around and had won with him and stuff. And he'd been a nice horse and everything. You know, broke his maiden for me at Gulfstream and then come back, went an allowance race and stuff. And then I had him primed to go at Churchill and couldn't get him in. I entered 11 times and they couldn't get a race for him. So I sent him to Tony and I told Tony to run him, Dutro. And he run him and he went and ate and changed like 4 days, 5 days after I sent him there. And Tony went on and won five in a row with them and stuff and everything and did really well. And then he came up in the sale here this year, and I jumped in and bought him again for the owner because Keeney still owned part of him, and come back and he was second in a stake, and then he win the other day and got claimed from me again. But he'd been a horse that had just been a lot of fun to have and a really nice horse. Little Distorted, who beat Revolutionary last year, first time out, and we sold him for a lot of money. I felt he was a very special horse. Ran a huge race, fastest buyer in the country for a two-year-old last year. I thought he could be any kind of horse. He was a special horse, and he's a horse that I think, I hope, comes back and does well for the people, you know?
Well, it's a great game. So many horses tend to kind of capture our hearts and become part of our family. I hear that from a lot of different trainers, Mike, for sure. I always like to spend about the last minute or so and ask trainers what it is they like to do outside of horse racing when they actually have a chance to get away from the racetrack. What other hobbies does Mike Marina have?
Mike Marina likes to golf and he likes to hunt deer.
Ooh.
So I got a deer hunt. I'm going deer hunting on Friday, actually, in Georgia. I went to Kentucky a month ago and hunted for 5 days and stuff. So that's part of the deals. Next year I'm going elk hunting in Montana. So that's one of the things I enjoy to do. And then golf is my other kind of pastime. So those are the two things there. And that's about all. And like Mr. Keeney once said, if I ever golfed in the 70s, he was firing me because he knew I'd spend more time at the golf course than I was at the track. So my golf never got great, but I still practice, you know. So anyway.
Well, you said your son was the golfer. Can you beat him?
Can I beat who?
Your son?
No, I can't beat Tripp, Hank, or any of them. No. I can't even come close to them. And that's been a lot of fun to go to the U.S. Opens with them, you know, and some of the things I've done there. And, you know, when you get an inside perspective on that and get to go inside the ropes, you know, and to the range and, you know, in there with the players and such and everything, it's always been, you know, it was a great part of my life for me and my son, you know, and stuff to go, you know, with them to some of the big tournaments and stuff and everything, and watch Tripp win, you know, and the U.S. Open in Chicago the 1 year where he was low scoring amateur and stuff and everything else. It's been a great experience, you know. So
he's trainer Mike Marina on Trainer Talk presented by Fazit Tipton. Mike, so much fun to hear your story. Like all of our guests who appear on the program, you're going to receive a gift courtesy of Flair Equine Nasal Strips. We'll get that out to you and want to say thank you for being here with us tonight. Great stuff.
Well, I appreciate it, and thank you for having me.
All right, Mike Marina here on Trainer Talk presented by Fazit Tipton. Terry Pompei coming up in the second half of the show. Stay tuned for that coming up next here on HRRN.
This is Trainer Talk on HRRN Live, presented by Fazit Tipton.
It can get pretty hot in February, especially at the Fazit Tipton Kentucky Winter Mix Sale. The 2013 sale produced 27 horses selling for $100,000 or more and 7 horses selling for more than $500,000, with the top 5 prices spanning from $625,000 all the way up to $900,000. With a sale average of more than $56,000, be sure you don't get left out in the cold. Enter your horse now for the Fazit Tipton Kentucky Winter Mix Sale taking place February 10th in Lexington, Kentucky.
This is Daily Racing Form's Dan Ullman with some big news about DRF bets. Thousands of players like you have already made the switch to DRF bets, and now there's an even bigger reason for you to join. Free DRF PPs. That's right. For the first time ever, get free daily racing form PPs when you wager with DRF bets. These are the DRF past performances you know and love, and DRF bets is the only place you can get them free. So why wager anywhere else? With DRF bets, you'll get the best sign-up bonus in the business, free guides and analysis from DRF's top handicappers, breaking news, analysis, and wagering on the go with DRF and DRF Bets Mobile, one-click multi-ticket wagers with DRF Ticketmaker, and now free daily racing form PPs. Only one place gives you the PPs you prefer when you wager, DRF Bets. Join today and wager with the most trusted name in racing. And if you sign up right now, you'll get a $125 cash bonus. Find out more at drf.com/bets. That's drf.com/bets.
The 2013 Daily Racing Form National Handicapping Championship Tour is off and running with tournaments virtually every week. Last year's NHC and Tour had total prize money of nearly $1.8 million. Jim Bennis, a horse player from Chicago, Illinois, landed the grand prize of $750,000, an Eclipse Award, and the title Handicapper of the Year. Find out more by visiting nhctour.com and join the tour today to begin your quest for the NHC in January 2014 in Las Vegas.
HRRN Live brings you live racing from tracks across the country. Join Chad Summers and the HRRN broadcast team as we bring you live racing every Wednesday through Friday, 3 to 6 p.m. Eastern on our new channel, XM208, or streaming live online at horseracingradio.net. HRRN Live is your source for live thoroughbred racing from coast to coast, only on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Go to hrrnlive.com for a complete schedule of tracks and races.
This is Jockey Orlando Bocachica, and you are listening to the Horse Racing Radio Network.
Welcome back to Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton here on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Mike Penna in our Lexington, Kentucky studios, and a fun visit in the first half of the program with trainer Mike Marina. And really looking forward to the second half of the show and our guest, Teresa Pompey. She goes by Terry. And of course, she's a native of Saratoga Springs, New York. She has saddled 357 winners in an outstanding career. And she joins us now here on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton. Terry, thanks so much for taking the time.
Thank you for having me.
Terry, this show obviously very much about you, the person, as opposed to so many of the good horses that you have in training right now. But when we look at your love of horses, if I'm not mistaken, it started at a very young age, and you credit your grandfather for that, right?
Yes. When I was like 3 years old, he put me on my first horse and happened to be walking up Geyser Road in Saratoga on its way to the vet. Someone was leading it with a rope lead shank, and he asked if he could sit me on top, and from then on I was just horse crazy, horse obsessed.
Is your family a racing family?
No, well, originally not. Of course, growing up in Saratoga, they all grew up there. Everyone really loved the horses and loved the meet at Saratoga. My grandpa actually spent every day he could there. But did they own racehorses or were involved in the training or raising? No, not at that point. I kind of dragged them into it over the years and, you know, with some success. But, no, they're not a racing family, even though we're from Saratoga.
And it's interesting that you didn't actually start with thoroughbreds. I guess when you started, it was more with show horses?
Yes, but we, at that point in the hunter-jumper world, we used primarily show horses, thoroughbreds. You hardly ever saw warm blood, which is the way it is now. But we used horses that were retired off the racetrack. And basically I started out, you know, at 8 years old taking lessons and wound up as a teenager showing the circuit, the A circuit, the B circuit, the C circuit, all around as far as my parents would let me go with it. So I did that, you know, hunters, jumpers, equitation, English, basically.
So your first love with the game was more on the, well, being in the saddle, more on the riding side of things, is that right?
Absolutely. I spent every minute that I wasn't in school or, you know, at home doing my family things at the barn, and rode many, many, many horses. You know, when I got more accomplished as far as riding, I was actually working for my show horse trainers, teaching other kids' horses how to be better or what schooling them. I spent hours riding. I love the one-on-one with the horse. I love the animal. You know, I love taking care of them. I love, and with horse showing, I also love the competition. I'm a very competitive person, so I always wanted to be the best. So I worked real hard at it.
Did you ever really expect that you'd be training horses, or is that something that you kind of had on your radar, or did you just kind of fall into it?
I knew I always wanted to do something with horses. It's just that I always knew I'm smart and knew that it was a very difficult way to make a living. And, you know, at that point when I was growing up, I only knew the show horse world, and that's really hard to make a living at that. Then when I got introduced to racehorses, I basically got introduced to racehorses and the racetrack because I started galloping in the mornings at Saratoga to kind of offset the expense of the show horses, and it just snowballed from there. I didn't expect to ever be a racehorse trainer. I knew I wanted to do something with horses, but the problem was there's really, I couldn't figure out the way to make a living at it. So I thought I would always do something, but not sure it would be my primary career.
Yeah, and even when you were in college, you attended Russell Sage College in Troy, and even when you were in college, you still continued to be around the horses and to ride horses, right?
Yeah, and I honestly picked that school because they had a good business management program, but also the main thing was it was close to Saratoga. It was close to the racetrack and the horses. It was close to my show. At that point, I still had one show horse. So it allowed me to go to the farms and break some yearlings and ride in the afternoons in between classes and go back and forth from Saratoga to Troy, New York. It's only like, you know, 25, 30 minutes. It's not a big deal. So I kept doing it all through college, and even after I got a real job in the real world, I worked for Warner Lambert Pharmaceuticals after I graduated, which eventually turned into Park Davis, which is now, I think, Pfizer. But I was a sales rep for them after college, a territory rep, and actually went up to a district manager. But I always got up early in the morning and went and galloped horses, or after work went and rode my horses.
Yeah, even then, did you know you'd be back at the racetrack when you were doing the pharmaceutical sales?
No, I tried to be what I considered a normal person, but I wasn't very happy at it. So I got to the point where I decided I just couldn't be, you know, I wanted to travel with the horses, and the winters were very depressing for me up there because basically the racehorses were all gone, and I had to work. I worked on a farm a little bit, but I really missed the whole business and the atmosphere and the horses, and I finally made the decision I was just going to follow my dream and see where it led me.
Talking with trainer Terry Pompey here on Trainer Talk presented by Fazit Tipton on the Horse Racing Radio Network. So, Terry, you graduate from college in 1983, and you get your job as a pharmaceutical sales rep. When did the riding career come into play?
Oh. Yeah, well, it was very short-lived. I was actually a really good exercise rider. When we had the Saratoga, Oklahoma track first opened for training in April and would close in November, I was there with bells on. I was the first one at the track in the morning and the last one to leave. I do 13, 14 horses a day freelance, work for certain clients there, Dennis Brida, you know, different people. And it just kind of snowballed from there. When I got out of college, everyone was saying, come on, you should ride. And so I rode some races, and primarily I rode races for people that were Saratoga trainers. They're the meet, like, you know, from April to August to November. They gave me a chance on some horses. And, you know, it was very short-lived, and I guess when that fall ended, I had to make a decision. I had a couple of offers from jocks agents to go to certain tracks, one being Suffolk, one being New York. But I was actually had a boyfriend at that point there, and I sat down with myself and said, can you see yourself being a jockey? And track and living in the winter and the cold and without your family and the whole thing. I just added it up, and I just graduated from college and decided, you know what, I don't want to be a jockey. I want to stay with the horses, but that's not what I want in my life. Even though it was so exhilarating riding the races, I'm not saying it wasn't. I tried to be sensible and just decide I'm not going to do it. So I stayed in Saratoga, and a couple of years when I basically was trying to get my job with Warner Lambert, you know, going forward, I had a couple ex-race horses that I was training to be show horses for people to sell, and that's how I kind of made a little money on the side also. But I loved riding the races. It was fun, but I really couldn't see myself, you know, in 10 years doing it. I just, at that time, there wasn't too many girl riders. It was, you know, just like when I started training, there wasn't a lot of girl trainers either. So it's extra hard, and, you know, I just tried to make a smart decision. Was it? I guess it was at this point. I guess I can say yes. At that point, I wasn't so sure.
Well, I know Amber Dana was pretty proud that you, and pretty happy that you decided to be a rider.
Yeah, it was fun. We had a good time, you know. And, you know, I have the pictures to prove I did it, but it was on to something else for me, so.
Yeah, and of course, Amber Dana, the one victory that you had in that brief riding career at Finger Lakes, so pretty cool. I know that that horse pretty happy that you decided to be a rider, at least on that one day. So take us from, all right, you're a rider, you're doing the pharmaceutical sales, all of those things after you get out of college. How did the training thing come to be, and who helped you along the way?
Well, what happened was I was with Warner Lambert like 5 years, and I would still gallop in the mornings, and then go to work, and, you know, I was trying to, as usual, fit too much stuff in a day. And I just got to the point where I was working for a trainer who is no longer with us, and his name is Ron Taylor. He actually was kind of like Tom Sawyer. Like, he would tell you how great everything was, and he would just disappear. So bottom line is I was galloping and running the barn like between 20 and 30 horses. And he basically was hardly ever there. What wound up happening is I was with him for years as his assistant. And then, we were seeing each other too, so I can't say we weren't, but what wound up happening is him and I split up and I wound up on my own. And, you know, it was kind of frightening at first because I knew the racetrack at that point was my whole life, as far as work. And then I loved the horses and I was used to the way I ran the barn. And now I was out with just, and when I left, I only had a couple horses. One my dad owned actually, and he had an old Bow Tendon and I had also a New York bred. I'm a Baroness that he owned. And I had like two other horses, and I basically started with four kind of sad horses and went off on my own. And that's how I got started on training. It was basically, if I wanted to stay in the business, if I wanted to, you know, I didn't aspire to be a trainer. I was enjoying the life I had. I was his assistant. You know, he had to deal with the major headaches with the money. I just took care of the barn and the horses. But then all of a sudden, here I was. Now, what do I do? And I just said, I'm going to be a trainer. And from that point on, it wasn't easy. But, you know, I worked hard and got lucky and wound up getting some good owners. And, it's, you know, it's had its ups and downs through the years. But, you know, here I am. And he basically, I kind of learned to train from the School of Hard Knocks because I didn't get much help in the beginning from him to learn when I worked for him, and then I just had to kind of go on my own. You know, obviously my dad was very much a supporter, and through the years I've met other people, owners included, that have really helped me. And basically, though, I learned from just watching, and everyone on the racetrack does things a little different, and you can learn so much just from watching other people. And you know, and realize that every horse is different also.
Do you look back on that now and that experience of having to, as you said, go to the School of Hard Knocks and learn that way? Do you look back on that now and say, hey, that really did help me to where I am right now in my career?
Oh, absolutely. At the time it was happening, no, I didn't think it was so great. But
sure,
it made me be very tenacious in what I was doing and very committed. You know, it made you want to dig in and try. And you know, for every two steps you took forward, you took one back. And it's still like that now, actually. But yes, I think learning that way, you know, it was a good way. I didn't come under the pampered shed row. Not that there's some great trainers that came that way. But I learned by being right in there, galloping, cleaning, you know, doing legs up, you know, having disasters happen, having great things happen, and, you know, doing it that way. So I'm also a single mom. I have a son from, you know, that Ron Taylor was the father of, and he never participated at all in his upbringing. So I also had him with me as an infant at the barn, and you know, he was there. So I had that also as an obstacle, which I'm glad now that I had, but it was a big obstacle at the time.
And how old is your son now?
He's 16, and he's doing great.
Does he want to be a trainer?
Absolutely not. He is actually a brainiac geek. He wants to go to Oxford in England for school.
Oh, wow.
He's very smart.
You better start winning some grade one races quick.
I know. That's what I keep telling her. He better get some scholarships.
Now, did I read somewhere, Terry, when you officially went out on your own back in the mid-90s, you did it under the stable name Nick of Time Stable? Is that right?
Yeah.
Where did that name come from?
That name came because I felt like I got out of the relationship and the the problems that I was in with him in the nick of time and went off on my own, and that's why I picked that name. It was a long time ago.
Talking with trainer Terry Pompey here on Trainer Talk presented by Fasig Tipton on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Terry, does being a former rider give you an advantage when you're training horses?
Oh, absolutely. I, as an exercise rider, all through the years, I galloped my own till probably the last 4 or 5 years. And basically now, you know, let's face it, you know, I'm 52. I don't bounce like I used to. So now I ride, I have a big stable pony, and I go out with every set. But I think a big thing is to have really good exercise help. And being a rider my whole life, I know you feel things that other people can't see. You feel, you know, the way the horse is flexing and bending. You feel the way they're using their body. You know from day to day how the horse feels, where sometimes a person on the ground doesn't get that. So as a rider, for years I got on my own, even when I was training, so it was really a plus. Now, obviously, I've gotten older. I don't know if you knew, I had multiple embolisms this summer, pulmonary embolisms. So I'm now stuck on the ground, which sometimes I hate because I really enjoyed the whole riding aspect of it. But as a trainer, I feel the most important help you can have in the barn is the people that you have on the horse's back, because I'm not there anymore, and you have to listen to what they say. You have to have good people that can tell you what's going on when they're on their back, because a lot of times you'll watch a horse go by and you'll say, wow, that horse looks good, and the rider will come back and say, no, a little left tie, not pushing off as good when he changes his lead. And you really can't see that. So it's definitely a benefit to have a good exercise rider. And that is one thing that I do miss as far as I don't get on him myself anymore.
Yeah, and I can imagine that has to also help you in communicating your thoughts to the riders who do ride for you on a daily basis.
Yes. So a lot of times you don't want to hear what they tell you either as a trainer. You think the horse looks good and they come back and tell you something. You're like, really? You gotta be kidding, you know? You don't want to hear it, but you have to take it into account. It's very important.
And you're a big fan of having other animals and even some birds around your shed row, aren't you?
Yes. I have. I had at one point a lot of birds, and one of my owners, who's a great lady, Wanda Polisini, she got me into that. She has a lot of exotic birds. I have a few birds in the shed row. We have a little goat this year. Every year there's something that we have. We had a little donkey for a while. But my hobby now is raising little finger monkeys. And I just do that as a hobby. And they're not at the barn. They're at my house. But I really enjoy it. You know, it's a little way to escape, to clean them and play with them, and they're very interesting.
Finger monkeys. So, yes. All right, for the illiterate here, when it comes to raising finger monkeys, what's involved with raising a finger monkey, and how many do you have?
I don't even want to tell you. I have 18.
18. All right, what is a finger monkey?
Yeah, they're marmosets and tamarins. They're small. They're under a pound. So it's kind of like having little birds in an aviary. I have different pairs. I have some really rare ones. They're basically my pets. I mean, once in a while I have to sell one because I can't have too many. But they're my pets, you know.
So is it
they're
harder training?
Interesting and they're fun.
Is it more difficult training racehorses or finger monkeys?
It's a kind of an all-day affair. You get done at the barn, you come here, you take care of your monkeys, you go back to the barn. You race, you know, it's all inclusive. So, but the horse racing is still, right now it's a little bit of a slow period. We're kind of regrouping from the chipping down and getting organized. So, it's a little slow right now. It's more like a vacation at Gulfstream here because I haven't gotten the groove. I ran one last Sunday. That was my first one.
Well, it wasn't a slow period for you 2 years ago when you won your very first grade one with a little horse by the name of Currency Swap, and I'm sure that's a horse that still holds a very special place in your heart.
Yes, I love him. He did great, he did great things for me and for my career as a trainer. He has gone now to stand stud at Woodford in Ocala, and I'm just so happy he got a really good place to go. We retired him. He had a couple surgeries, and we ran him once back in Saratoga, and he got a little tired in the race, but we talked about it, and we decided instead of keep campaigning him where he couldn't compete at the same level that, he should be at, we decided to try to find a spot where he could stand at stud, and he wound up in Ocala, so hopefully he's going to throw some really fast babies.
Would that be your career highlight, Terry, winning that grade one race at your home track of Saratoga with your whole family there?
Oh, absolutely. It was so much fun. It was great. My first grade one at Saratoga, a race that for years I had, been looking over the fence at, just wanting to be there someday. And it was a complete thrill. It was a complete thrill. And then the next year he came back and he won the Amsterdam. I mean, he really was a good horse for me.
Now, if I'm not mistaken, by the way, talking with Terry Pompey here on Trainer Talk presented by Fasig Tipton, you also had a little bit of a stint where you were a bit of a TV star in the early days, right?
Oh, yeah. you know everything.
Yeah, you didn't think I was going to dig that one up, did you?
Yeah, and there was before there was like HBO and cable, they used to have the CBS movies of the week, and I played Christy McNichol, who she used to be on Family. I played her double in a movie called My Old Man that was like a CBS movie of the week, basically. And I did all the riding scenes for her, and I did another movie with Bruce Dern. I can't remember the name. It was a gangster movie. It was shot up there also, where Bruce Willis gets thrown over in cement shoes. It was a gangster movie. And I was in that, a small part in that. I did like 3 or 4 I Love New York commercials. But the big one was My Old Man, because they shot at Saratoga like the whole month of June and July, like June, half of June and most of July, they shot the film up there. So it was very exciting. And it was in 79, I believe. And I paid my first year of college with the money that I made out of that. So.
Wow. Wow. And did you always play the writer's role in those movies?
Yeah. Yes. Yeah.
Okay.
At that point in my life, I was probably one of the better riders up there as far as show horse riders and knew how to gallop a horse, in 1979. So the good thing was when I did the movie with Christy McNichol, we were like the same size, same hair color, so it worked out really well. She didn't do any of the riding, actually. She was scared of the horses.
So what else does Terry Pompey, outside of raising finger monkeys, what else does Terry Pompey enjoy doing when you're not at the racetrack?
Let's see. Well, I like to go to the beach. I like to shop. That's pretty much it. And most of the time I'm at the track or you know, home here with my other pets or with my son doing something. But nothing, not too much travel. I try to get away once a year for a few days. And I am going to Saratoga for Christmas to see my family. But most of the time I stay pretty close to here. You can, when you have a lot of horses and you have other pets, it's hard to make plans to go anywhere.
Yeah, you know, it's funny you say that. Because I've asked so many trainers over the past year or so on this program, I ask them that question toward the end of the interview, and so many times trainers will say, you know, I really don't have time to do anything else. There's certain things that I like, but horse racing is my life, and it takes up so much time that you don't have time to do a whole lot of other things. Is that true?
Yeah, absolutely. Even if you're not running, you usually have to go back to the barn. You got to go to the racing office. Sometimes you're looking to claim a horse. The vet comes, there's always something. Or you just have clients that come into town and they want you to go up and spend the day with them at the races. So, when the season gets rolling down here or anywhere, it's always like that. And, you know, we get up really early in the morning. We're at the barn at 5. We get home like 11, 11:30. You change, you go back to the barn, back to the track. And, you know, by the time you look up, the day's over. It's ready to start again. So it does. It goes by fast. And it's hard to get, like, we don't get weekends off. So weekends are our busiest time. So it's pretty much 7 days a week thing, you know?
So you mentioned your son going or wanting to go to Oxford and obviously not being interested in following in your footsteps and being a horse trainer. But is he a big fan of racing? And does he come out to the races with you a lot?
I hate to say this, no. No. I tried to make him a hot walker for a while to help me out. One, I would save salary. Two, I'd give him something to do that, you know, get him kind of interested. He hated it, and I was always worried he'd get run over or something in the barn. I said, you know what, I'll get you a job doing something else. He would rather stay in the house or work inside. He doesn't like bugs. But he's a really good kid. I mean, I never have to worry about him drinking or doing drugs or anything. He's like living with an 80-year-old man. So, you know, in that way, he's good. But no, I hate to say, I don't know if it's bad or good he doesn't want to follow my footsteps. I think his life can be a little crazy and vagabondy. Obviously, we move twice a year right now. I've been lucky. At least I don't have to. He comes out of school. He starts school in New Jersey. And he's done this since he was, you know, started school. He comes down here. He does his winters here, and then he finishes back in New Jersey again. And he's done that all along, and he gets A's. So I don't know how he does it, but he's, you know, he does that. But no, he is definitely not going to be a horse trainer. So I don't even see, like, down the road him thinking, waking up one day and thinking it's something he wants to do. I just don't. He's not. He likes when I win. He's happy for me, but as far as participation, he doesn't want to do it. So.
Well, Terry, it's a great story, and can't thank you enough for being here with us on Trainer Talk tonight to share that story with us and let everybody know about your career, and want to wish you all the best moving forward. I'll look forward to seeing you when I get down to Florida here, and all the best for Terry Pompey and that racing stable as you move forward over the years.
Okay, well, thank you for having me.
Thanks so much, Terry. We appreciate you being here.
Okay, thanks.
All right, trainer Terry Pompey, our special guest on Trainer Talk presented by Phasic Tipton. Mike Marina in the first half of the show. If you did miss any portion of the show, you can go back to our website. Later on tonight, there will be a podcast available. That's at horseracingradio.net. You can listen at your leisure. You can also listen to us, Horse Racing Radio Network, on iTunes. And we will remind you to follow us down the road to the Kentucky Derby is your official radio home for the 140th Run for the Roses. Of course, the Preakness Stakes as well. You'll hear all the Triple Crown events with us right here on HRRN in 2014. And you can follow us through social media at HRRN on Twitter, Horse Racing Radio Network on Facebook, and of course, through our website, horseracingradio.net. Listen online anytime on your phone just by visiting horseracingradio.net and clicking the Listen Live button at the top of the homepage. Fun stuff. Mike Marina, Terry Pompey. Our thanks to Phasic Tipton for all their support of Trainer Talk. We're with you every Wednesday night with this program. Don't forget, Thursday nights, our Bristnet.com call-in show from 6 to 7. And on Friday evenings, your Express Bet Weekend Stakes Preview. Saturday mornings are Equine Forum from 8 to 10, and that entire live racing coverage schedule for you on our website, horseracingradio.net. For my producer, Lee Della Pina, Mike Penna, Baron of the Backstretch, we will talk to you next time. Thanks for listening to Trainer Talk, presented by Fasic Tipton.